Before we start, please note that this podcast features sexually explicit content and descriptions of violence and crime. Over a century ago, Lancaster, Pennsylvania was a wide-open city for prostitution, liquor, and gambling, otherwise known as vice. City officials tolerated and even encouraged these activities. Police knew where the brothels were, but instead of shutting them down, they socialized with sex workers. The mayor himself was known as a live wire whose philosophy was live and let live. In fact, there were several well-known gambling games within a stone's throw of his office. That all started to change in 1913, when four detectives came from New York and Rhode Island to Lancaster for an undercover investigation of vice. They were from the American Vigilance Association, which was an organization dedicated to eliminating prostitution across the country. These investigators left behind their accounts of their travels through Lancaster's hotel lobbies, alleys, bars, and brothels. They wrote detailed notes about their conversations with brothel keepers, who were also known as madams, as well as waiters, sex workers, and bellboys. Their papers include 750 typed pages, photographs of sex workers and their houses, drawings of the layouts of brothels, and sex workers' calling cards. In addition, a local anti-vice agent who was not undercover kept copies of his handwritten notes about gambling, obscenity, commercial sex, and drinking, in 10 bound books spanning from 1913 to 1917. These typed reports and handwritten books make up the Vice Files. Our goal for each episode is to introduce you to a person we have encountered in these unpublished files. The Vice Files often reveal secrets that a person hid from public view, or simply details considered too trivial for news reports. But these details help us to reconstruct a person's struggles and motivations, their sorrows and success. To us, these files are more than details about places and activities. They reveal people who wouldn't ordinarily make it into history books or onto markers or monuments. It is worth getting to know them, because they show how seemingly ordinary people navigated legal, political, and economic challenges, and how vice fit into people's everyday lives of work and play. Now here's how each episode works. First, we present a profile of our featured person using public records, mainly newspapers from their lifetime, but also census records and court documents. The rest of the episode will focus on what the unpublished Vice Files say about the person. This is episode 1. Kennedy Eckert, Young Sport. Meet the public Kennedy Eckert, a part-time bellboy and local billiards champion. Kennedy Duff Eckert was born on January 24th, 1891 in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. His father John opened a glamorous shoe store in Lancaster, but it went out of business in 1895. By 1910, when he was 19, Eckert was in Atlantic City working as a bookkeeper in a newspaper office. Perhaps the Eckerts moved to Atlantic City for a fresh start. After all, Atlantic City, with its famous boardwalk, was an enticing and convenient place to remake yourself or to try your luck in moving up the economic ladder. The boardwalk's fantasy and glitter may have drawn in John and his teenage son. But by 1911, Eckert was back in Lancaster working as a bellboy at the Wheatland Hotel. Named after President James Buchanan's Lancaster home, the Wheatland Hotel opened in 1902 at 160 North Queen Street, the heart of Lancaster's theater district. It was 6 stories tall with a grand oak staircase. A chef from Philadelphia ran the hotel's cafe. In 1910, when the Edison Electric Light Company installed a decorative display of 4,000 light bulbs in the city center, the Wheatland Hotel had an illuminated banner, and nearby department stores, cafes, and liquor stores had new electric signs and bunting. Eckert made news many times in Lancaster. We think this early mention in the newspaper is particularly revealing. In 1914, he fell down the stairs at the Wheatland Hotel, spilled food from the tray he was carrying, and ended up with cuts and bruises. He stayed on the job despite his injuries. Wheatland's location was convenient for travelers, who came into the city by train or trolley. It was only a few blocks from the train station near 200 North Queen Street. It was also close to city amusements, such as Dorsheimer's Palace Pool Hall, which Eckert frequented. In 1913, there were 11 billiard or pool halls listed in the city directory, which doesn't begin to account for the number of tables in bars or other social hubs. By 1915, Ecker had earned the title of local champion, and the newspapers noted that he was welcoming challenges to his title. Then, in 1916, Eckert became the manager for the new Hoffman House Pocket Billiard Parlor. In 1914, Kennedy Eckert married Edna Bulbach on Valentine's Day. They had a son and a daughter. In 1917, Eckert enlisted in the Army, specifically the Aviation Division. The Eckerts eventually moved to the outskirts of Philadelphia, and they had one more child in 1924. This is the public Kennedy Eckert, the bellboy in Lancaster City who shook off some bad breaks and moved to the suburbs, where he supported his wife and three children as a bowling alley manager, fumigator, and a guard at a quarantine station up until his death in 1964. After he moved out of Lancaster, there is no further news of championships. The man we know from the newspapers is scrappy and competitive, trying to make it under the city lights. There is more to Kennedy Eckert, however. Let's open the Vice Files. Meet Kennedy Eckert, the guide to Lancaster's vice. On November 3, 1913, Eckert met Ralph Neeland, an undercover investigator for the American Vigilance Association, around 1 a.m., likely in the lobby of the Wheatland Hotel. The Vigilance Association was an organization of clergy, social workers, and businessmen. It worked to eliminate commercial sex and protect women and girls. In particular, the association attacked the idea that commercial sex should be allowed to operate openly in a segregated district in the city. It sent teams of investigators to cities across the country to document commercial sex and produce reports to shock communities and spur local authorities to action. Neeland, who was 37 at the time of his Lancaster investigation, was the younger brother of George Neeland, the director of investigations for the Vigilance Association. At their first meeting in the early morning hours of November 3, 1913, a Monday, Eckert took Neeland to a brothel on North Water Street, which is at one end of the four-block stretch of Lancaster's best-known red-light district. There were brothels elsewhere in Lancaster, but many houses were concentrated on Water Street. Here, red lights shone through the transom windows, cabs idled in front of houses, and the player pianos in the parlors could be heard on the street. This concentration of brothels is in the 4th Ward, which had some of the lowest quality housing in the city and a mix of poor, immigrant, black, and white residents. This neighborhood also included coal yards, a tannery, and the Conestoga cotton mills, which employed a large number of women. Yet, this area, known as the Tenderloin, was not monolithic. The brothels got cheaper and more run down as you travel south on Water Street. The intersection of Water Street and West Mifflin Street was particularly poor. The cost was $1 in the brothels on the north end of Water and 50 cents on Mifflin Street. In 1913, an investigator for the Law and Order Society wrote that West Mifflin Street was narrow and filthy, and every house is apparently a body house. On Mifflin Street, sex workers called out prospective customers from doors and windows. They wore knee-high kimonos and used vulgar language. A few blocks away, houses were more private. Sex workers wore elegant gowns and used refined language. Furnishings here were expensive. There were oil paintings on the wall and wool rugs on the floor. On Mifflin Street, there was no indoor plumbing. Workers tossed sewage in the street from slop buckets. Brothels on Mifflin Street were dirty and foul-smelling. The location of red-light districts in poor neighborhoods with high concentrations of black residents was a common practice across the country. Black leaders spoke out against how the vice districts in their neighborhoods brought the most disreputable whites to their streets. While the organization of vice helped enforce segregated neighborhoods, the commerce in brothels here was racially integrated. In fact, racial mixing in the brothels in Lancaster contrasted with segregation in theaters, where white and black patrons sat in separate areas, and in restaurants, where black citizens were sometimes refused service. Racially integrated vice largely protected white men's access to black women's services, but as brothels became cheaper, the racial hierarchies within them were less clear. In some cases, cheapness meant that white customers were not preferred and had to compete with black men for access. Eckert did much more than show Nealon the red light district. In his first outing with Nealon, he also pointed to the popular gambling games in town, identified some passing women as prostitutes, indicated who had sexually transmitted infections, or as he said, who was diseased, and spoke casually to the policemen they encountered.
"Go on, you son of a bitch. I'll take that club away from you and hit you over the head with it. You're a hell of a cop."
The policeman laughed and passed on. Kennedy Eckert also told Ralph Nealon stories about other men's indulgences in commercial sex and drinking.
"I know a fella who goes to F&M. He's from the South and his name is Tom. Anyway, his father sends him $50 a week, and I don't believe he has a regular room in place. Keeps changing around. He starts out about 9 in the evening and takes in the whorehouses. He insists on spending most of the money and tells the fellas he can afford it better than they can. I was with the crowd one night, and we landed in Common's place at 217 West Lemon Street, and he bought all the booze she had on hand."
By the end of this first outing with Eckert, Nealon had already learned the basics of vice in Lancaster. There was a red light district along Water Street. Vice in Lancaster was hardly a secret. Police knew about vice and didn't stop it. Nealon summarized in his notes what Kennedy Eckert had taught him. "It would take a volume to write all he told me of conditions, but from his description, vice in all forms is rampant here." But there was much more. Nealon's travels through Lancaster's vice grew more shocking with each outing. On Wednesday night, at 9 p.m., Eckert and Nealon knocked on the door of Dutch Vera's place at 420 North Market Street. She opened the door only a crack. When she saw Eckert, she let them in, and they waited with two other men in the dining room. They conversed with a resident sex worker named Bessie, who explained that she had 3 gold teeth after being shot by another prostitute and had a bullet still embedded in her jaw. Eckert told Nealon about his previous activities at Dutch Vera's.
"I won $87 shooting crap at the gambling house in Penn Square. I came here with 5 others to celebrate. I gave Vera $50 for the exclusive use of the house for the night. We all got drunk, and there were only 3 girls, the fellas doubled up, each girl entertaining 2 fellas."
All told, the men spent 10 days together exploring Lancaster's vice. On November 13th, their second-to-last night out in Lancaster, Eckert took Nealon to Madame Carmen's on Lemon Street at 2 in the morning. Nealon described the scene in his report.
3 girls came in, also Madame Carmen. All of the fellas were well known here, and there followed a lively time, with vulgar, smutty talk by both girls and fellas. The girls kept urging us to buy drinks and to go upstairs. One of the fellas was especially vulgar. He offered any of the girls $20 to give an exhibition on the parlor floor and $5 to any girl who would strip naked before the crowd and other things impossible to describe. He made a remark to one of the girls, a big blonde girl, about perversion, intimating that she practiced it. The girl jumped up and fought him all over the parlor, nearly pulling his hair out by the roots. It took Madame Carmen and 2 of the fellas to separate them.
What did investigators mean by perversion? This term referred to non-procreative sexual activity, typically oral sex. The final outing for Nealon and Eckert was the search for an open brothel at 3 a.m. Eckert pounded on the doors at 241 Howard Avenue, then on 2 other doors further down the street. when the madam opened a window on the second floor of 327 Howard Avenue and said the girls are all in bed. Their next stop was 401 North Water Street, which was basically a tumble-down shanty. Eckert was usually undaunted, but even he thought it was a dangerous dive and worried they would get robbed, so Eckert and Nealon called it a night. The Vice files reveal yet another layer to Eckert's role in Lancaster's vice. Meet Kennedy Eckert, young sport, pool shark, and a thorough degenerate. These are the terms the investigator Ralph Nealon used to describe him. Nealon first identified Kennedy Eckert as a young sport. A sport was the word for a man who celebrated his promiscuity, frequented prostitutes, and ignored calls for self-restraint, even in the face of warnings about disease. Sporting culture was a realm of male camaraderie and entitlement, but sports like Eckert were also struggling to get by. The sporting world was not entirely criminal, although it included some crime. After all, a sport like Eckert gambled and participated in commercial sex. Sporting culture also overlapped with legal entertainment, such as cheap theaters, bars, and restaurants, which were all places to find pleasure in the city. Eckert was a regular in Lancaster's nightlife, criminal and legitimate. He was not just a pool champion, he was a pool hustler and gambler. The point is, a sport wasn't just an expert guide. He was a participant in vice. Sports enjoyed showing off and shocking others. Kennedy Eckert was no different. He bragged to Nealon about frequenting prostitutes. Nealon even thought he might have been a pimp. He paid for sex, although at a highly discounted rate, with Bessie. Bessie wore a salmon-colored knee-high silk dress. Eckert went upstairs with her and afterwards announced that she had only charged him half price. Eckert then explained to Nealon that Bessie had been his old girl. He thought he was the father of her young child, but she was supporting it without any of his help. To do so, she had moved into a brothel. Nealon tried to find out more about this child, but Eckert sidestepped his questions. Nealon then talked with Bessie away from Eckert to find out more about how she was making a living.
How are you getting along? Are you making any money?
I made $18 last week, but I owed the madam money, and I still owe her a dollar, beside my board.
How much board do you pay?
$150 a week. Then there's a doctor to pay every week.
Then you can't save much.
No, I ain't got nothing.
We include the conversation with Bessie here to show that girls and women served men in the playground of sporting culture with little reward, and often suffered consequences that the men did not face. To understand sporting culture and vice in more detail, we need to know more about pool halls and hotels a century ago. Pool games were cheap to play. It was about a quarter per table, and the cost could be split between the number of players. Working-class men gathered in pool halls to watch and bet on games. They could also access slot machines and share tips on nearby brothels. Eckert once asked Nealon to play pool for money. Nealon refused when he realized that Eckert was just trying to con him or play him for a sucker. For all these reasons, pool halls were suspicious places in the eyes of middle-class reformers. The Palace Pool Room on 153 North Queen Street was owned by the Dorsheimer brothers, George and Dan. This was Eckert's favorite. Compared to other pool halls, it received the most attention from police. On Christmas Eve of 1911, the police raided the pool room because it had been open on Sunday, in violation of Sabbath laws, and had allowed boys under the age of 18.
A few years later, George Dorsheimer was charged with statutory rape after he had sex with 15-year-old Annie Harsh.
He was eventually sentenced to 10 months in jail for adultery. A few months later, Annie Harsh was sent to Slayton Farms, a reform school for wayward girls, after being accused of theft and indecent conduct at a park. Newspaper accounts of her case noted her involvement in an affair on North Queen Street, which was likely a reference to the statutory rape case at the pool hall. It was not unusual for judges to punish the teenage girls involved in these kinds of cases, even though these laws were initially proposed to protect girls and women. Like pool halls, hotels were also central to vice.
They were not just places for weary travelers. Hotel lobbies, like pool halls, were hangouts for loafers who were looking for a bit of excitement in the city. Hotel workers were the main go-betweens for vice. Waiters and bellboys shared where to find sex, gambling games, and liquor. Sex workers also brought their clients to hotels. To try to curb the use of hotel rooms for commercial sex, clerks sometimes asked to see suitcases and marriage certificates from couples looking for space. It was not hard to find a fake marriage certificate and a spare suitcase, however. Bellboys did not just share information about brothels in town, they also provided sex to guests. Men staying at the Wheatland Hotel ordered drinks late at night to draw bellboys up to their rooms for sex. While working as a bellboy at the Wheatland Hotel, Eckert described three different occasions where he had perversion practiced on him for money and for pleasure by several men. Once, an actor invited Eckert and another bellboy, Twistler, to his room in exchange for money. The bellboys stole this actor's keys and took the money he had stored in his trunk. The actor wanted to take Eckert and Twistler to court, but they blackmailed him by threatening to expose him for hiring male prostitutes. Neeland and other investigators were interested in documenting same-sex activity, even though they were reluctant to publicly discuss it. The first Vice report in Lancaster refers only briefly to same-sex activity, stating the problem was impossible to print. Across the country, investigators usually came across male sex work when they were investigating female sex work or youth delinquency. They treated male and female prostitution differently. Reformers did not imagine young men and boys who were involved in sex work as sentimental victims, and their punishments were usually longer than girls and women's, sometimes including permanent institutionalization. Boys and men were almost never brought into prisons, reform schools, or hospitals as a result of consensual sex with girls or women, while girls and women were often punished for heterosexual promiscuity. It is important to emphasize that boys and men were arrested and imprisoned for same-sex crimes, even if they did not involve prostitution. In other words, consensual same-sex activity was defined as deviant and criminal in the early 20th century, even when it was not commercial sex. The Republican administration reluctantly began to crack down on vice in 1914, and many establishments lost their liquor licenses, including Hoffman's Parlor Pool Hall. There is no record of Eckert being arrested in the crackdown, but it might have disrupted his livelihood as he began to have financial and legal struggles after the crackdown. 1917 was a transformative year for Kennedy Eckert. His wife had their second child, Jean A. Eckert, in 1917, and that December, the newspaper announced that he enlisted in the Army's Aviation Division. However, his life as a low-level criminal finally caught up to him. In April of 1918, Kennedy was arrested for stealing a $20 gold certificate. This gold certificate signified ownership of what would be approximately $400 worth of gold today. We could not find any follow-up to the outcome of this case. We know that he appeared in the Army records soon after this charge. His official enlistment date was June 20th, 1918. However, his Army career was short-lived, and he was discharged on July 31st, 1918. His discharge was not honorable. It was based on his poor job performance, the official term being inefficiency. Out of the Army as a 27-year-old husband and father of two, Kennedy faced financial adversity. Kennedy Eckert was involved in a dispute with the Keystone Furniture Company in 1918. It seems that he could not keep up with the payments on the furniture he bought on installment for his family. He bought one crib, a crib mattress, a comb, a mattress, a high chair, 16 yards of matting, one davenport, six oak chairs, one extension table, two rugs, one kitchen table, and a motor washer. His legal battles over gold and furniture were the primary activities in Lancaster in 1918. By 1930, he was living with his wife and children in Marcus Hook, a small town outside of Philadelphia. His occupation is listed as bowling alley manager, and in one newspaper he said that he played pool every day of his life for 43 years. Pool and bowling were sites of vice a century ago, but did they remain so in Eckert's life? Perhaps once a sport, always a sport. But there are no further reports of his involvement in any criminal activity. No other reports about gambling, loafing, drinking, selling sex, or patronizing brothels. Perhaps this is simply because there are no secret vice files to document any underground activities in this later period of Eckert's life. We are left wondering about the mystery of how, exactly, this young sport grew up. Thank you for listening to episode 1. Please listen to the other episodes of The Vice Files about Amanda Brenneman, Notorious Madam, and Barbara Foreman, Charity Girl. You can also learn more about these topics by taking the Lancaster Vice Walking Tour through the city. This podcast was created by Allison Kibler and a team of students from Franklin and Marshall College. Jaden Lacoe, Kylie Logney, Rachel Rubens, and Dylan Sykes. Narration by Dylan Sykes.